Local underwriting is provided by the UCSF Stress and Depression Study, recruiting premenopausal depressed women not taking antidepressant medications for a study of immune responses to stress. SAD at ucsf.edu.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Capital Notes, our weekly look at California politics and state government and all those kind of fun things. That was a new intro. I'm John Myers from KQED Public Radio, and Anthony York, the editor of Capital Weekly, here with me in our studio across the street from the state capitol. We're back in the studio this week.
That's it. We're back in our cave.
Right? In our cave, in the Batcave. Because if you listened last week, we were in the hallway outside the governor's office staking out a Big Five meeting between the governor and legislative leaders.
And Trez, exciting.
Indeed, it was Trez exciting. And of course, there was no deal on the budget at that point. And as we come to you here on the 29th, on Thursday, for the week ending the 30th. Because this will be out
if
on
your
Friday.
Weekend's on a Friday. Then yes.
I get my days all confused when we do this tape on Thursday, podcast on Friday. As we sit here on the 29th, on Thursday, we still have no budget deal. But that shouldn't shock you if you're a frequent listener to our podcast. And if you're not a frequent listener to our podcast, then the question is, why are you listening? No, we're happy that you're here if you're sampling us on one of our many venues. So obviously most of our news again is budget related. There were a few other little things out there, but there, what I think interesting, even though we don't have a budget deal, is that there were different news stories through the week that come back to either the intractability of the problem or the seriousness of the problem or some combination there. I mean, there are all these things that continue to make me feel like the proverbial storm clouds continue to darken and gather.
Well, and the third factor is, I think, the lack of specifics coming out about the problem, which leads to those of us whose job it is to write about this stuff to regurgitate some of the stuff that's been out there.
Yeah, you've said this a couple of times. There haven't been a lot of leaks lately.
No, and I think that that's a good sign. I think that there was a rocky beginning to the Big Five in this incarnation, as it began with Daryl Steinberg entering the mix when he assumed the pro tem ship. Back on the 1st of December, and there was a little personality learning curve, and I think maybe the fact that there aren't leaks coming, not that it was Steinberg per se who was leaking things, but that the comfort level.
Yeah, get yourself in trouble with Steinberg staff.
Because I know that they actually listen to this.
Yeah, exactly. One of them was on the
that's
show
right,
last week.
That's right.
Anyway.
Yeah, so, but just I think that there was a learning curve on the personality stuff, and they seemed to at least be more comfortable enough with each other so that the cone of silence is back in order.
Yeah, and I mean, obviously there's got to be a personality mix anytime you get those five people, just by definition of their jobs, five very
massive egos.
Well, no. I was trying to find a more polite way of saying it. But five very forceful personalities, good. We'll call it. I mean, you know, because
that's why you don't. That's why I got beaten up more as a child. way with words.
I tried to hide in the corner. But yeah, I mean, you don't get to be governor or the leader of a caucus or the leader of one chamber of the legislature without having a really forceful personality. And you know, you get all those people in there. And the mix has got to be different every time. We've had transitions, as you've sat here talking about. Had a new pro tem. We have had a new speaker the year before that. We had a new Republican leader in the Senate before that, the old man of the group there being Mike Vallines, the Assembly Republican leader. They've all got to find a way to work together. But there hasn't been a lot coming out of those meetings. They just keep saying, we're working on it. You know, lots of things on the table. I think the governor said at the Sacramento Press Club on Wednesday, he said something like, you know, all these radical ideas get talked about, you know, and that's good. You know, and we don't want to talk about them in public, but it's good that people are talking radical ideas. I can't imagine how radical it would get, but
right. pretty radical. we're gonna annex Oregon. It's gonna solve all of our problems. then we're gonna cut down all the trees and sell them to China.
Taking in Oregonians and taking their trees.
Yep.
I like your thinking.
It will help with the AB 32 problem, carbon offsets, and
there's a reason you're not in the room. But
I guess so.
There's a real reason you are in the journalism world and not in the government world. Well, let's talk about a few of the things that happened this week. I'm not really sure where I'll start. Let's start with the one bit of news that happened here on Thursday. A Superior Court Superior Court judge in Sacramento ruled in favor of the governor, that the governor has the power to unilaterally furlough state workers for 2 days a month, somewhere on about 230,000 state workers, give or take. Of course, there's that weird thing about state employees who work for a constitutional officer, you know, controller, lieutenant governor, who those bosses said they're not going to furlough people.
Right.
But that the governor has power to do it. The unions argued that the governor didn't have the unilateral authority and that the governor may have some authority to do layoffs, but furloughs was a much more murky area of the law, and also said that a furlough, which would amount to about a 9% salary reduction a month for the average state worker, was effectively a salary decrease, and that a salary decrease could not happen without consent of the legislature. The judge basically said, nope. I mean, you know, in a short way of saying it, and saying that the governor has powers, emergency powers, in the midst of a fiscal emergency, and pointed out places both in state law and in the labor contracts themselves where it implied that the governor had that kind of power. So I think the governor won a big victory there. The labor unions can appeal this ruling. But we also know that the biggest labor union, SEIU, that represents a lot of state workers, is still at the table with the governor's administration trying to find a compromised version of a furlough.
Well, and remember when last we left this situation, the controller had just intervened on behalf of the unions.
Yeah.
And last Thursday, when we recorded the podcast in the hallway, the governor's office was telling people that they thought that negotiations were going to blow up over this. Remember, I think...
Yeah, Big Five negotiations were going
to
blow up, right?
Right. And the argument was that if the governor doesn't have the power to furlough state workers, then he has no leverage with them in the bargaining room. And so, you know, overall, whether or not there are furloughs as part of a final budget deal, it sounds like they're talking about saving $1 billion to $1.5 billion.
Dollars. About 1.3, I think, is the number out of the general fund.
Right, worth in employee salary. So how, and you know, Democratic leaders told us, we heard from Jim Evans, the spokesman for the Senate leader, Daryl Steinberg, last time, that the Democrats want the governor to work that out directly with the unions. And you mentioned SEIU is still at the table with the governor, even while they're tangling in court. And I think if you get that piece out of the way, that's going to be a key building block of any final budget compromise.
And I think, you know, what's interesting too is that there was a debate in court, and it had been out of court a little bit, but I was in the courtroom this morning, in Judge Marlette's courtroom, where the back and forth was going on, and the case being made by some of the unions outside of SEIU, you think the ones that represent like attorneys that work for the state, for example, said that the funding for a lot of their positions comes out of special funds, not out of the general fund, and tried to make the argument that the governor says this is due to a general fund crisis, then why is he going after employees whose salaries don't come out of the general fund? Well, even though that didn't hold water with the judge in the final ruling, the piece of information that the governor's administration will argue, which I think is interesting, it's not quite a multiplier effect. That's too clever a way to try to say this. But you know that a lot of the budget solutions on the table talk about using special funds, in effect, internal borrowing and some kind of one-time deal and then paying them back later.
And there will be.
So the theory becoming that if you free up special fund money, you can use it also to help general fund needs. And when you get that, you actually get closer to about $2 billion in savings out of that $40 billion shortfall. So, I mean, you know, there are ways that the argument goes. You get some real push out of this decision.
Right. And you know, the big news out of this decision is that the governor has retained his leverage in negotiations with labor unions.
The thing that remains from here is it gives the governor some power.
Right. Right. And you know, I'm sure that's part of the final solution. Is that too ominous a wording?
Nah, not yet. Okay. Not yet. I know where you're going with it, but yeah, final solution, I can live with that. And you know, also this week, let's not forget too, that we had a big action in Washington, D.C. on a federal stimulus plan. Still got to go to the Senate, pass the House.
Right. Now the president, like the governor, needs two Republicans in the Senate to go along, right?
Oh, yeah, in terms of the rule of 60. Huh?
Right.
So the stimulus package has a lot of money, let's just put it that way. But when you look at California, and I think the numbers are hard to evaluate here. I mean, it depends on whose analysis you look at this bill. And I mean, it's bad enough trying to read state legislation. Trying to read federal legislation is even worse. But I think somewhere on the order of $20 billion, 21, 25.
Over 2 years.
Yeah, over 2 years. Now, not all of that $20 billion could go to help solve the deficit. I think most estimates are about 10, 11, maybe even upwards of 15
right.
could go for, you know, things that would actually impact our deficit problem. The rest of them could go into stimulus issues, infrastructure, public works, things that the right. governor has said, quote unquote, we have projects that are shovel ready
right.
that could help stimulate the economy. But that, you know. I'm sorry, you were going to make a joke.
No, I wasn't.
Oh, sorry.
You just evoked my cat's litter box when you said shovel ready.
And, shovel ready.
Yeah.
That's not something you want to tell everybody. but if you take the money, I'm just trying to do some math here. You take the stimulus money for a budget solution. Let's say $10 billion. Let's say you take $2 billion out of the state worker money. That's $12 billion. You know, that's real money when you're getting to $40 billion and you really got tough choices about program cuts and things like that. And then, you know, maybe the $10 billion actually could be larger from the feds if you count other different kinds of things. I know somebody's going right. to write me in and tell me I'm doing the math wrong. But, you know, those are big developments. I think, you know, getting you to finding that as the, again, using the governor's words from this week, that sweet spot
right.
Between the warring sides. That's got to be a big push.
Well, and what's interesting is how what's going on in Washington affects the negotiations in the room. I know that Democrats, you know, would like to be able to get a real number from Washington and score it as savings or money, you know, to solve the $40 billion problem that we have in California. Republicans, mostly the governor, has been out there saying, no, whatever we do, we cannot assume we're going to get a dime from Washington. If we do, we can pay money back, but we need to put together our own $40 billion solution that does not involve any of this, you know, money that may or may not be coming from D.C. I wrote a story this week for Capital Weekly looking at how that the action by the House this week may have affected those big five negotiations.
Yeah.
Everybody was very tight-lipped. But, you know, but fair to say that I think Democrats are counting on Democrats especially are counting on money from D.C. to offset any potential cuts they'd have to make. And for Republicans, they're going to take that money as money to offset any potential tax increases. So, you know, the educators in particular, a lot of that money is going into education for K-12. For new school construction, for special education programs, for Title I, which is the big federal grant to help poorer kids mostly. You know, that's where the bulk of the money is going to come in from the stimulus, and that's, I think, you know, what they're waiting for.
You know, and I was just thinking, though, about the governor's comments about, well, you know, we can't put that money in our, you know, we can't take that federal money and you know, mark down how much we've got to solve, et cetera, et cetera. I think that's fine. But with all due respect to the governor, I think that's an opening gambit. You know, that's a way to try to push a larger solution. But you know, push comes to shove and you're looking at the cliff, going over the cliff, right. I can't see the governor walking away from a package that's laid to him that has a number in it from the feds. Because right. let's be frank, year after year, over the recent years, we have put in things that don't ever match up. And the criticism is still
we've got
out
a good
there.
List, What's right? That? There's a good list.
Oh,
there
it's
was
a great
the
list. Yeah.
The judgment money from legal judgments was right. going to go into the general fund.
Tribal gaming money that didn't quite
right.
come out
didn't
to the size
out.
It was supposed to be.
And you could even make an argument about this lottery bond that was in last year's budget.
Yeah.
Which voters still have to vote on.
Sometimes.
You know, yeah.
But yeah. So I mean, I see where he's going. I understand his principle, but I think he's more of a pragmatist than that.
Well, and that's exactly the argument that Democrats are making, that making the assumption that we're going to get some money, say, call it $10 billion from Washington, makes a heck of a lot more sense and is a lot more realistic, is a lot closer than some of the things we've based our budget assumptions in the past. So,
The other thing that that we were watching this week, well, there are more than one thing. The other thing that I think is worth noting is that I think everyone agrees that there is no way to not stop. Let me rephrase that. Yeah, I know, exactly. Just couldn't get it out of the brain quite. This is why in radio we do it more than once and you never hear the outtakes. I'm leaving them in now. We're going to keep it real today, York. Okay.
Bloopers and all.
Bloopers and all, you know, so watch your tongue. But I was going to say that I think everyone now finally agrees that there's going to be some impact from this impasse starting next week, starting in February. You know, the controller, John Chung, has talked about the cash flow crisis and talked about all the payments he might not be able to make and this might not be able to happen.
Tax refunds.
But the reality is, and the controller's office says it as recently as this afternoon in talking to them, come Monday, there will be payments the controller will not make. And the legislative leaders acknowledged this coming out of a Big Five meeting this morning. I talked to Daryl Steinberg briefly. He knows it. He knows that there's going to be some impact. You can't avoid that completely anymore, right, because these have gone on too long. And the first impacts it looks like we're going to have are some of the money that the state sends to counties every month to administer the Medi-Cal program. They typically make those payments on like Mondays and Thursdays, I was told from the controller's office. So guess what? Monday, they're not going to get a payment. There's also another large amount of money I was going to mention quickly, $280 million scheduled to go out the door in the next, I think, 10 days, 2 weeks, something like that, for regional centers, which if those of you don't know what regional centers are contracted by the Department of Developmental Services largely to deal with developmental disorders, right, the biggest one of those these days being autism. That money directly goes to pay for services for children, you know, for intervention in those programs. That's $280 million. So, I mean, my point here is real impact is right around the corner, you know, and the question I think that will be interesting to answer is, does this finally resonate with Californians who have been very good at just not paying attention to the problem?
Well, and I think that it resonates certainly with the legislative leaders. I mean, you talk to people of, you know, the Democratic leadership or the Republican leadership, there is a real awareness of this February 1st deadline. And I think that's part of the urgency and the seriousness around these negotiations now. You've got the added bonus, of course, with the Super Bowl this weekend, that if they reach a deal this weekend, they can bury it, presumably.
This is the big conspiracy theory. This is the conspiracy theory you were telling me about before we started.
Right.
So that effectively no one's paying attention to the bad budget deal because they're rooting for the Steelers and the Cardinals?
Well, like the governor unveiled his budget on New Year's Eve.
Did it work?
For a couple of days. Anyway, I mean, but I think the real thing is the February 1st deadline. It happens to coincide with Super Bowl weekend, but you know, that's something that is very real, and I think that that Democrats are very concerned about. I mean, these are exactly the kinds of programs that they're trying to save in the budget deal. I mean, a lot of in-home support services, some support services for the developmentally disabled. These are the things that Democrats are trying to protect in the budget talks.
There's also some SSI, SSP money that doesn't go out the door for aged, blind, and disabled. As we have often said it. So when we back up here to the macro issue, I mean, you know, Anthony, you and I were talking about this before we started the podcast. I mean, there are, you know, if I try to whittle it down into two simple things, there is the tax increase debate and there is the budgetary reform debate, which I'm going to call just the debate on a possible spending cap.
Right.
Democrats want a tax increase and are telling Republicans they got to get on board. Republicans want a new formal cap on state spending or some kind of limitation on the growth in state spending and say, Democrats, you have to get on board. Those are, I mean, I just think you can't ignore it. Those are the polar opposites. Those are the two, the goalposts. What's the image I want? Those are the two, issues. Those are the prongs. Those, help me here.
I don't know.
Work with me. You're a word.
The cones. Smart. The cones there on the outside where you mark the out of bounds lines. Anyway.
Okay, good. Thank you.
How's that for eloquence?
I'm sure someone will write in with something better.
I'm sure we'll think of it ourselves in a moment. But yeah, I do think, I think there is some middle ground. I mean,
but that's a question. Where is it? You think there is?
I do. And I think that if there is some middle ground on this, it would be devising some sort of formula or system to stabilize the revenue flow. That if you can, to find a way to identify what's called in the trade, the one-time money, right? Money that comes, it's a one-time windfall for the state, which spikes all sorts of spending formulas and then gets spent on programs that cost money year after year after year. So when that money goes away 2-3 years down the line, then suddenly there are deficits. If there's a way to stabilize, to identify some of that one-time money, put it away in a reserve so that, you know, to sort of, to level out the peaks and valleys of the budgeting crisis, I think that that might be some middle ground.
Isn't that what the governor's rainy day fund proposal that was passed in September as part of the budget would
part do? Of it. That's part of it, but I think that that they're looking for something even stronger and some language that actually identifies what one-time money looks like. And if there are ways to codify that and identify it, that, that might be something that that Democrats would go along with.
Well, I'll tell you, the other thing that I noticed this week is that if the yelling and screaming from the interest groups is loudest before the deal is struck, then maybe we are close to a deal. Because, right. I mean, the ramping up of the anger on both the left and right sides of the political world is really getting palpable. I mean, in this past week in particular, we got a whole lot of angry on the right side about taxes with Republicans. Talk radio guys in L.A., I mean, like what? Like basically putting up, you know, the equivalent of wanted posters of Republican members of the legislature who might have said something in the press about taxes. I mean, in other words, you know, every both sides has their quote unquote special interest, and they and we've been hearing it from the left for a while. You know, labor unions, education groups, other people.
Right, but you know, there's a new poll out this week that indicates that perhaps that those really are the extremes, and that the majority of Californians might be willing for a combination of some spending cuts that are painful and some tax increases, yep.
Let's talk about it. It's the Public Policy Institute of California poll. It's not the new Capital Weekly poll.
That's
when is that coming out?
That's next week.
Next week. Drum roll.
I know.
Okay. But the PPIC poll that came out on a Wednesday night, right, it went through a whole litany of these. I mean, first of all, we should say that Californians seem awfully optimistic about President Obama. Even Republicans surveyed were optimistic about Obama, but they're unbelievably pessimistic about Sacramento and state government, their governor, their legislature, et cetera. So, right, so there were some different things that were rolled out there. Let's see, they asked questions about what you would save or what you would cut, right?
Right.
And most people wanted to save education, shocker. And the thing they were least interested in saving was prison spending, shocker. And then there was then the thing that got a lot of attention, which I guess is really what we could come back to and talk about for a moment. Was the question of, do you favor lowering the requirement for a passed budget from a two-thirds vote to a 55% vote in the legislature? And for the first time, a majority of those surveyed said, yes, I favor that. That was the proposal in some form that got rejected by voters at the polls in 2004.
Right. I'm skeptical because if you look at the wording of that question, I mean, a lot of the debate over how people feel about that issue is how the question is worded. I mean, if you worded it a different way, say you worded it, would you support lowering the vote threshold to make it easier for the legislature to raise taxes? You might get a very different answer. Well, and that's the way that they would frame the debate over lowering the vote threshold.
Except that, but what you just hit on what I think was the most fascinating part of that is that for anybody who wants to start, you know, like popping champagne corks on the left and saying, look, the voters might be willing to do away with a two-thirds vote.
Right.
That's a two-thirds vote to pass a budget. The Constitution also says a two-thirds vote to pass a tax increase, as you just alluded to. That's part of Prop 13. That's not what was questioned out of
right.
this survey. And I would submit, I think as you would, that the voters would be much more leery of doing away with a supermajority vote for a tax increase.
Right.
And if that's the case, then that still would not solve, a 55% vote would not solve the $40 billion problem unless you used the magic majority tax increase that
right.
Democrats proposed several weeks ago. In other words, that's not the silver bullet. That's not the way to get out of the problem.
And there was some talk earlier this year about going back to the way it used to be in California, where if you only had a 5% increase in spending, if the budget only increased by 5% or less, then you didn't need a two-thirds vote. You only needed a majority vote.
It was the old historical thing that was removed out of the Constitution, I don't know, a few decades ago.
And there are some Republicans, I believe Mimi Walters has a proposal that supports that. Mimi Walters, a conservative Republican from Laguna Niguel.
Yeah, state senator.
You know, would support that idea. I mean, Tom McClintock had voiced some support for that idea. But, you know, Democrats fear that that would be a de facto spending cap, that then there would be no incentive for Republicans to ever vote for a budget, and that Democrats would be forced to pass a budget that only increased spending by 5% or less.
Well, and I just think, too, though, even outside of that, I mean, call me the cynic, but I just think that also, you know, in the modern era of governance versus the era that existed before, everybody's really good at the trickery, at the sleight of hand. Right. So you say that growth, you know, spending didn't increase, you know, spending increased 4.92% because you pushed some of the spending to budget the year
special
plus fund one
or right.
a special fund. The trickery has gotten so good, and I guess that's kind of where I would come back to. The trickery has gotten so good that I don't know what mechanism you enshrine in the Constitution that somebody can't get around.
Can't do it. I mean, it's like campaign finance reform. People draw up these laws trying to make them ironclad, and then you know, it creates a cottage industry of people who get paid a lot of money to find
a
ways
way
around
it.
Them.
Yeah. So, gee, that's optimistic. But I mean, but at the end of the day, I mean, don't you think that those two issues, spending, tax increases, and some kind of spending limitation, those are the deal, and that's where you've got to resolve that before you get a deal.
I do think so, and you know we'll see if a larger reserve with some leveling out of revenues might placate some of the concerns on both sides and might be a compromise, or whether it's something like a de facto cap where you say you know maybe it's not 5%, maybe it's 8%, or maybe there are ways of structuring it where Democrats would feel comfortable that they could manipulate the number every year. You know.
Yep.
There might be something like that is part of a deal, absolutely. I think it has to be.
And we would be remiss if we didn't point out that same poll, the PPIC poll, asked people about a new spending limitation. 70% of the respondents said, yes, there should be a new spending limitation. So I think, again, the voters have thrown you a curveball if you are on the left or the right on that issue. You know, we might want to reduce the budget vote, and we might like a spending cap. So there
right.
you go.
I think people like the governor would say, exactly. You know, both of you have to compromise. That's where
Probably
I am. That's where the people are.
Probably
right.
works for him,
Probably
even though
does.
His job approval rating was pretty low.
Well, he doesn't have to run again.
That's true. That's true. If somebody gave us job approval ratings, I'm not sure they'd be that high either.
Someone gave us jobs, we'd be happy, though,
I
right?
I was going to say, I hope that's I have it. Mine come next week, but stay tuned. If there's a podcast, you know I do. Well, I think that's it.
On that note.
I know, right? We didn't even have an ending.
Well, at least we created a cliffhanger for next week. Tune in next week to see if John Myers is employed.
Oh, I was going to talk about the budget. Now you're just now you're really depressing me.
You brought it up.
I brought it up.
All right.
Well, you know, I'm waiting for word from San Francisco. If the bosses are listening to this, should I put in a plea?
Let's hope not.
Let's hope not. Okay. We hope to be here next week. So thanks for listening. For Anthony York from Capital Weekly, I'm John Myers from KQED. See you next time.